Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for today's podcast is John Schneider. He's the CTO of Agile Delta, was one of the driving forces behind E4X, or ECMAScript for XML, and he's currently evangelizing efficient XML, a new proposal for an alternative binary representation of XML. In this conversation, we discuss the motivations for efficient XML, its theoretical foundations, and its practical applications. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, John?
I'm pretty good. I thought that we could use this time to clarify the principles of efficient XML. I've kind of read through your white paper and the stuff that's out there.
Okay.
And I realized that I'm vague on some of the core concepts here, and so if I am, then I'm sure a lot of other people are too. It's probably a good idea to just review for people who don't have the context where this comes from and what the motivation for it was and what the near-term application areas that you see are.
The core motivation for efficient XML is really to expand the XML community and to extend the reach of XML to a wide range of new applications, applications where it couldn't be used before. And so, you know, XML has been so phenomenally successful, and there's this great thriving community and tons of tools in the commercial marketplace. There's lots of competition, which drives quality and drives prices. It's a really good thing for everybody who can tap into it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a wide range of applications that can't tap into it, that require a certain level of efficiency. Wireless applications, a lot of times, can't really tap into XML because of the bandwidth requirements. Unlike processing power, bandwidth is actually quite expensive and doesn't evolve at the same pace. So it's somewhat of a persistent problem. It doesn't follow Moore's law like a lot of other things do.
Right. But you should probably elaborate a little bit on what you mean by wireless applications, because I think it's not quite the same as what a lot of people will think, which is, well, I'm in Starbucks and I have pretty good bandwidth.
I'm focused really on all wireless applications, but some of them feel the pain more than others. So we're talking about handheld mobile devices and the like, PDAs and smartphones and mass market consumer phones. Connection points where people would like to get at a wide range of information. If I'm in the airport, I want to know what's happening with my flights while I'm sitting in the restaurant. I don't want to have to get up and go look at the kiosk every time.
But isn't it the case that often in that scenario, you might have sufficient bandwidth, but the constraint is the small memory of the device and its lack of the kind of power that's needed to process the XML efficiently?
When we talk about efficient XML, we're talking about several different kinds of efficiency. Fundamentally, we're reducing the resource requirements for XML. So a big one for people is reducing the requirement for bandwidth, but at the same time, we're reducing the requirement for processing power.
Mm-hmm.
We're reducing the requirement for memory and CPU power. And something that's extremely important to mobile device vendors is we're reducing the requirements for battery life. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The fewer CPU cycles you use, the less battery life you use. And more importantly, the less time that radio is on the device, communicating back and forth, the less battery life you used. The processing is certainly important, but actually when you look at the applications and where they're constrained, more often we find out it's actually bandwidth over processing power.
Okay.
So as an example, I mentioned battery life. There are some studies that occurred at Helsinki University to look at how much battery life does a radio use versus how much battery life does the CPU use.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is on average, every byte sent over the radio used the same amount of battery life than 100,000 to a million processor instructions. So the big thing when you want to preserve battery life is actually to keep that radio off and to have that on less of the time and send less data.
Okay.
Similarly, it's interesting, there's been a lot of little studies in the past about binary XML and exactly, you know, how much it gets you. And most of them seem to be conducted in a lab where you have a high bandwidth network connecting two computers side by side. In that environment, you're not going to be network bound. Your CPUs are going to be operating at full speed and not blocked on the network.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you add a wireless node or a node that's remote, or as soon as you add more than one person hitting the server, you find that all of a sudden your applications get network bound. And when they're network bound, it doesn't matter how fast you make the CPU or how fast you make the process, it's going to be sitting there waiting idle while it's trying to send things over the network.
Okay.
Size matters. So if you can make the data really, really small, you're going to get a lot more efficiency out.
Okay.
Instead of getting something two times as fast, you can actually get something 50 times faster. Several of our customers are getting results right now that the systems will speed up 100 times faster, especially on a wireless network.
So let's talk about ways of making things smaller then. I'm looking at your proposal right now and reading through the part about schema-based compression. As I understand it, you will leverage an XML schema if available, but you'll still compress very effectively if there isn't one, since an awful lot of XML is schemaless. I'd be interested to hear sort of on both sides of that what the story is, first with and then without.
Sure. To start with, we did a lot of listening about people's experiences with prior attempts at binary XML. You know from other things that I've worked on, I'm a big fan of things that are late bound.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a huge fan of things that are completely early bound, because a lot of times they tend to be brittle.
Yep.
Early bound works for some applications, but you need to be flexible. And so Efficient XML actually follows that model. You can be as early bound or as late bound as you like. You make the decision on how much schema information you might want to leverage. But unlike prior binary XML attempts, everything still works if your data doesn't follow the schemas that you're using, or, you know, if it will handle arbitrary deviations from the schema. If you drop in some new chunks of XML, it's okay, you know, and your applications can leverage those things or ignore those things or whatever they choose to do with them. So you can have an environment where it's completely schemaless.
Okay.
Or you can have an environment where you're leveraging big, hefty enterprise schemas that some people have. Or you can have an environment where you're leveraging some schemas and then some information doesn't have schema about it. Okay, so maybe you choose to just use the SOAP schema for your envelope, but the payload doesn't have any schema at all. Or vice versa, if that's what you want to do.
In the case where you are completely schemaless, are you mm-hmm. then no more effective than ZIP? Or if you are, how are you?
It's actually quite a bit more effective than ZIP. The reason for that goes back to kind of the roots of our research in Efficient XML. Information theory, which is what compression and ZIP and things like that are all based off of,
mm-hmm.
it's something formed by Claude Shannon back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
tells us that the minimum size of a piece of information is a function of what you know about the data. ZIP and algorithms like that actually learn about the data by analyzing it, which of course takes time and processor resources.
Yep.
So they'll go across the data, they'll look for certain patterns, they'll find things that are occurring frequently, and come up with smaller bit representations of those frequently occurring things,
yep.
which on average gives you a big size reduction. But the minimum size of a piece of information is a function of what you know about the data. We have a head start on ZIP, even without schemas, because we know it's XML.
Mm-hmm.
And the XML grammar tells us a lot about what's likely to occur in a document, okay? So without analyzing the data, we already know what's going to happen.
So, for example?
Well, we know, for example, that the first thing that's going to happen in a document is the XML grammar tells us, you know, it's going to be a comment or a processing instruction or a doc type or a start element, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas ZIP doesn't know anything about that. It actually has to learn about all these concepts by analyzing the data. And if the data is not very big, it doesn't actually learn enough of anything to have any effect on it.
Just the fact that you know you've seen a start tag and you're kind of expecting the companion end tag gives you a little bit of a leg up.
Right. There are some other things that we do as well. One thing that's particularly surprising to people, in fact, they just don't believe it when they hear it, if they have a background in information theory, is with Efficient XML, we can actually beat the information theoretic lower bound on the size of a piece of information. And it sounds like you're breaking the laws of physics, but you're actually not. The reason for that is because with information theory, they define the information theoretic lower bound, and I know we're going kind of deep here, based on a channel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So a channel is just a chunk of bits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so you can analyze that channel, and there's a theoretical minimum bound on how small you can make it. With XML, there are clever ways that we can look, because we understand the structure of the data. We can look at the data and say, well, you know what we have here is not really one channel, but it's several channels. And each of those independent channels are more regular than the whole channel taken together.
So what would be an example of a sub-channel within a document that somebody might be familiar with?
Well, let's take a real simple example. Let's just say we've got a couple of elements in there, and some of them have numbers in them and some of them have letters in them.
Okay.
And they're just interstrewn throughout the documents. You know, you get some numbers and some letters and some letters and some numbers, et cetera, and they're all in separate elements.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, the letters and the numbers won't necessarily compress well together because they're not very similar.
Right.
Okay, so if you take the whole thing as one channel, then you'll actually find that you don't get very, very good compression on it.
Okay,
depending on the size and how much data you have. Okay, but if you separate those two channels into, I've got numbers on one channel and I've got letters on another channel, both of those things will compress independently better than they will together.
Okay. And so if you had, for example, namespaces within a document, and what was in one namespace tended to be numeric, then that would be really helpful, right?
You got it. Exactly. Okay. You can divide things up by namespaces. You can divide them up by queue names. There's lots of interesting ways you can chop things up to achieve much higher compression than if you treated it as a single channel.
Okay.
And so as a result, what we found is that sometimes not only can we beat the information theoretical or bound, but we can actually beat it by, say, like five times sometimes.
Wow.
Okay, so even in cases where, usually when you have really large, regular documents, okay, very repetitive, large documents, WinZip will just tear those things apart, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we can still get about five times smaller or three times smaller even than that on those documents.
Huh.
And WinZip, in those cases, is actually getting close to the information theoretical or bound because of the way the algorithms are structured.
Hmm.
So that's very surprising to people.
That's very interesting. Then we add in schematization and what then becomes possible and why.
Let me jump back for a second. Efficient XML has a characteristic that none of the other binary XML attempts have had, which is that it's completely data-driven, and it's completely grammar-driven in particular. And so schema-based encoding is exactly the same algorithm, exactly the same thing as schema-less encoding. The difference is that in one case you have the XML grammar, in another case you have a grammar that's more informed by a schema.
Hmm.
So it's just some additional information about what's likely to occur in the stream.
You don't really treat those as different cases?
No, you don't. They're the same. What we've done is we've unified a whole bunch of different techniques, and that's very important for mobile devices because you can have a very simple, small data-driven algorithm that you can put on devices that don't have much memory.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to go out and build a separate parser for the schema case and the schemaless case and the fragment case and the case where I have schema deviations, then I'm going to end up with this huge pile of complex code that won't ever fit on a mobile device. Effectively, what you end up doing is implementing four or five formats instead of one format. And in fact, that's the approach that a lot of people have tried to take in the past, is to say, okay, we need a schema-less encoding, we need a schema encoding. What happens when we get schema deviations? How do we handle that? And you end up with kind of a big pile of code that won't fit on a mobile device. Fundamentally, you know, what we're trying to achieve, which is also different from what others were trying to achieve, is to say there's no application anymore where XML can't be used. We want to achieve the efficiency of a hand-optimized binary format with XML. And so any application that needs that level of efficiency now has no excuse not to start using the open XML standards and the tools and tapping into the XML community.
Hmm.
Everything we've been focused on has been kind of aimed in that direction. It actually works out well for, particularly, we've got several customers now that have invested huge amounts of dollars in proprietary binary formats that they needed because they need that level of efficiency. And now they can start using inexpensive open standards in those places. And they can start getting interoperability with all the rest of their XML tools.
I have a sense of what you mean when you say that this stuff can be internally binary, but look to XML processors like what they expect. If you could sort of unpack that for me, I would really appreciate it. And I bet a bunch of other people would too.
I imagine so. It's a common question that we get is how can it be binary and XML both?
Yeah.
Really what we've done with Efficient XML is to provide an alternate syntax for expressing XML data. There's a binary way to express the data or a text way to express the data, and you can always convert from one to the other and back if needed, and there's a straightforward transform for doing that. There's a one-to-one correspondence between what's an element in one form and what's an element in the other form.
Mm-hmm.
We try to make this as invisible as possible, so we embed it in the lowest possible layer. So what you have is now a parser or a serializer, or we tend to call it a codec, that knows XML and knows efficient XML, and your application gets exactly the same stream of events it always did. So if your application sits on top of the standard DOM interface, the document object model interface, then it'll get a DOM tree like it always did, and it doesn't necessarily know or care whether that data came across in binary form or text form. It gets exactly the same DOM tree. Same thing with SAX. So it sits underneath the SAX interface, and so you get a stream of SAX events, or you generate a stream of SAX events from your program, and you don't necessarily care whether it's coming or going in a more efficient form or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's also support for stacks. There's support for JaxP on the .NET platform. There's support for the APIs there. as well. The idea is that the programmers have already climbed the learning curve and learned all about XML, all the XML technologies, all the XML APIs, and so they should just be able to read and write the same way that they always did.
Yep.
Just happens to work more efficiently.
And so the trick here is the quote-unquote appropriately modified implementation of DOM or SAX or what have you.
That's right. And with something like JAXP, for example, in Java, there's a pluggability infrastructure. So you can just say, I'm going to plug in my new parser, and all of a sudden now my application knows efficient XML and XML.
Okay.
Now, there's a really cool case that we're able to do with web services. So a lot of our customers are using standard SOAP web services. The nice thing there is because of the standards that have been put in place with deployment descriptors and WSDLs and schemas and the like, you can actually just drop in a SOAP handler. And the SOAP handler plugs itself in, and all you really have to do is drop in a library, modify a configuration file, and now your web services can use either XML or efficient XML. In our efficient web services solution, it also has content negotiation built into it. And so what happens is you plug this in, it's invisible. Your application logic stays the same. You don't have to make a single change to it. And it will automatically go out and figure out which other clients or servers support efficient XML. It'll talk efficient XML with them. It'll talk XML with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And if a new one comes online, it'll see that, and it'll actually switch to efficient XML. So the more nodes you have on your network that support efficient XML, the more scalable that network becomes and the faster things go. But it's not required by any node in the network, and it switches invisibly.
Where do efficient XML aware parsers and processors come from? You're supplying some. Other people will be able to supply others.
Yes.
At some point, you know, this gets to sort of the standards question and the evolution of this along that dimension. Where are things at the moment? Where do you hope things will be in a year or two?
Well, in a year or two, I hope that we'll find it everywhere. The idea is that any XML content, in a year or two is probably a little optimistic, but the idea is that you would like to have any XML content to be available in this form so that you can access that content from any kind of device or any kind of wireless network or any kind of embedded system or automotive system or set-top box or, you know, for Pete's sake, the refrigerators nowadays are connected. But from any device you want to, you can access that data, and you can access it with the efficiency needed to support those mobile and wireless applications.
Okay.
We're a software company, and we sell software. So we do have several different implementations of efficient XML that our customers are using now for Java and Java mobile devices and .NET and .NET mobile devices. We're heavily involved in the standards process. We proposed efficient XML a few years ago, so we're about a few years down the road. We've got probably a couple years left to go before we have a standard in hand. What we're doing in our implementations is tracking the standard as it progresses so that our customers can start using the software now if they'd like to. They can make sure that it actually works for their applications. They can give us feedback that we drive into the standards process so that it's based on implementation experience as opposed to a paper standard that's never been implemented.
To your knowledge, who outside of Agile Delta has so far done an implementation of efficient XML?
Nobody outside Agile Delta has done an implementation yet.
Okay.
They haven't actually had the wherewithal to do that yet, but that's what we're working towards in the World Wide Web Consortium.
Okay. So right now, the folks who are using the, let's say, the .NET implementation are using it as a licensed binary from you.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It is a license. It's a perpetual license, so they buy it and they own it forever. We also realize that people want to track the standard, so they generally come with free updates to the software for the first year.
Okay.
And then if people want to go beyond that, they can choose to do that as well.
Okay. The uses to which it's been put so far sounds quite broad, right? Ranging from optimizing the flow of web services traffic to intermittently connected handheld devices in a military environment.
Yes, our objective with this was really to achieve interoperability. I mean, really the whole objective is to expand the group of applications or maximize the group of applications that can use XML to communicate or to interoperate. And so we wanted to make sure, you know, if you're going to maximize the number of applications that can actually use this, you need to make sure that it works for the wide variety of use cases. And so it's been used for web services. It's been used for in high-volume message routers. It's been put on aircraft. It's been put in vehicles. It's been used for satellite broadcast. It's been put in a whole bunch of different mobile devices, PDAs, and the like. It's been put into application servers and web services. There are simple HTTP proxies you can actually point your browser at that will now enable those browsers to do efficient XML or XML. In fact, we did that on some aircraft with some customers where they wanted a real quick way to get this into their system. They had some large pieces of data they wanted to access, so we just put in a HTTP proxy on the aircraft and back in their control center.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden they're browsing megabyte documents over an airborne wireless network, but they're going across the network in about 11K.
Right.
So about 100 times smaller in that case.
Right. And then sort of on the other end of the spectrum, there's this very interesting possibility that you and I have probably talked about this, but I know I've also discussed it with John Shutuk at Microsoft a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very big on this idea that if you can kind of abstract away the differences between inter-process communication on a single box and inter-process communication across the network, then that starts to get really interesting.
Yeah, you've got this very interesting distributed system at that point.
Yep.
A distributed system like that is almost always network bound, and so you've really got to address the points of pain there.
Now, I'm trying to scope out who else is involved.
We've got a good list. Some of them are customers of a binary XML format, like Chevron Texaco is in there. Some of them are application server vendors, like IBM is on the group. Some of them are mobile device vendors, so we've got Nokia and Siemens on the group, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to remember all of them, but we've got a good-sized group. This is the second group we've stood up to do this in the W3C, and I know the previous group we had about 27 companies, which is about as big as you want the group
mm-hmm.
to be. And that group was responsible for identifying requirements and use cases and the like. And then the second group that we've got stood up now is to actually define the standard. So the first group was to really look at it in detail, look at a lot of use cases, look at all the requirements, and make a few decisions. The decisions were, is this really valuable? Is it something that the W3C should do?
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible? Because there are a lot of people that thought that you couldn't really come up with a single binary format that actually served all the diverse needs of the XML community and all the different things that people wanted to do. So that was actually our objective from the start, was to come up with a single general purpose format that was actually very optimal for a wide range of use cases.
Right.
Not easy, by the way. We did have to break from the traditional approaches that people have taken and take this approach. It's kind of a marriage between information theory and formal language theory. And efficient XML is the only binary format that's actually gone down that route, and the only one that actually achieves the results it does as well.
Is Microsoft in this or not in this? I can't find any.
Microsoft is not a member of that group. They've been very interested, and they're watching very closely, I'll say that.
Right. Well, my hat's off to anyone who can navigate the standards process. I know you've been there before, really a number of times.
Yes, that's true.
That's a world that I have observed from the outside, never been on the inside of, and I really can scarcely imagine all of the the combination of skills.
Yes,
let's just put it that way. That is required.
Well, thank you, John. It does require a lot of different kinds of hats in that group, and the what I call the co-opetition model is always very interesting and dynamic, where there are a lot of different interests from different parties that are getting thrown into the mix and bringing everybody to a point where they're all nodding up and down and going, yes, that's what we want, and then what they want is actually something good, is
mm-hmm.
sometimes challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I was very proud of what we were able to accomplish with the, about the E4X group, the ECMAScript for XML group.
Yeah.
And that was a case where we had all the big vendors and browser folks involved, and at the end of it, they were all nodding up and down, and I was really, really happy with the result. So to me, that was kind of an existence proof that says you can have a standards process that works, that everybody gets kind of what they want, and still come up with a really good technology
mm-hmm.
out the backside. So.
Mm-hmm. So from your company's perspective, you're going to be providing this in a variety of forms, or
yes,
you already
right.
are, actually. Maybe you should talk a little bit about what those are and the different footprints and configurations and so on.
Sure. So there are a whole bunch of different places where this applies. We've got a bunch of different implementations that are already completed, some that you can come to the website and download today. There's a trial that you can go and download, and some that you'll be able to see pretty soon. There are Java Enterprise Edition support, and the Java Standard Edition support, so that'll fit into any application server or Java application. You can plug it in as a codec, which basically means there's a whole collection of APIs, all the standard XML APIs that you can just call directly.
Underneath all the Java normal XML stuff.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
So if you're already doing DOM, or you're already doing SACS, or you're already doing STACS, or JAXP, it's all in there.
Right.
And so if you already know all those interfaces, you can go in and start using this right away and plug it into your application. You can access it directly through the APIs. There's also a little command line interface that you can use as well. It's just kind of fun to play with, get an idea how it works so you can encode documents, try different options, and it's a very quick way. You know, within a few minutes, you can be up and running with it and play
mm-hmm.
with it and see how well it works.
Mm-hmm.
There are also .NET releases that are going to be out very shortly, both for the server side and .NET Compact Framework. On the Java side, also, there's support for J2ME, very small footprint implementations that you can put on a wide variety of PDAs or smartphones or whatever you might have that needs to get connected to the network.
In browsers? I mean, it seems like the DOM overhead is a huge drain on a lot of resources now that everything's gone AJAX.
Yes, I certainly think that you'll see it built into browsers. In the meantime, I mentioned that we have HTTP proxies. So any HTTP application you have, including SOAP or web browsing or whatever,
right.
You can put an HTTP proxy up. And with your browser, you know, most people know how to configure a proxy nowadays. You just go up and configure a standard HTTP proxy, and it drives all your traffic through there.
Yep.
If you're accessing efficient XML files, or if the server sends you an efficient XML file, it'll automatically unpack that, and it looks just like the XML. And so the proxies and that kind of integration really drive home for people the fact that it's just a separate way to transport the data, because when you click on an efficient XML file or you click on the XML file, you see exactly the same thing in the browser.
Is well-formedness the ante here? In other words, if I was shuttling XHTML around and I had this proxy, would I be getting the benefit? And if it weren't well-formed, then I wouldn't?
Right now, that's the case, yes.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be that difficult, actually, to support the other kinds. It's just a matter of time and resources to do it. As I mentioned before, it's a data-driven strategy that's driven off of grammars. And so, since that's declarative, they're very easy to change and modify to describe HTML just as well as XHTML.
Hmm.
But, you know, obviously, XML is where most people are headed, so that's the first,
right.
The first thing you see.
The John Chuchuk vision.
Mm-hmm.
Is that everything kind of looks like SOAP and everything plays with the same toolkits.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you want to talk to your USB thumb drive, you're going to be just regarding it as a peer set of services in the same
right.
way that something that was out there in the cloud would look like a peer set of services, and that unification of programming models would be a big benefit because we still think about things in very different ways right now. It's a kind of a lofty and somewhat remote idea, I suppose. But, I mean, this is, well, we could actually get there.
That is exactly the vision that we're chasing after. You know, the tagline that we run around with is any data, any device, anywhere.
Yeah.
And what it says is exactly that unification you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no reason why any device should ever use anything other than XML.
Yeah.
If you can make efficient XML, which is what we've done, as efficient as something somebody can do by hand,
yep.
then you look around and you go, why would I build something myself? It's
yep.
really expensive to build and maintain. I don't have this huge user community and developer community out there. I don't have all the libraries that I can go download for free. I can't use standard web services. Why would you do it? You no longer really have to sit down and hand design your assembly language anymore. Now you can get a compiler to do it for you. It's the same thing with efficient XML. You no longer would have to sit down and hand design your own binary format. You've got a machine that'll do it for you, and it's in general better than you are at it anyway. Machines
mm-hmm.
are good at packing bits.
A lot of people would say, well, yeah, but, you know, why do we just have to have this one hammer for every nail, and, you know, why does everything need to be XML? And I've actually, well, tell me what you think about this, but I have this one slightly speculative, but to me still quite interesting example
sure.
of how that could matter. So let's assume that we're in a world where things are nicely service-oriented and we've started to do a pretty good job of factoring out things like policy from applications.
Mm-hmm.
So that, let's say you have a certain policy in your organization that's going to control the flow of a certain type of XML document, subject to some compliance regulation, right? And
right.
Now, you know, you're in pretty good shape to the extent that you've got your desktop and server applications kind of flowing through these XML gateways and policy application and enforcement. That's all starting to look pretty good. And then one day you say, oh, crap, there are these USB thumb drives.
Right?
So now that policy, which I have factored out and made completely general in this other domain, needs to be special case implemented for that, right? You know, for this device that can get stuck into the computer and create this covert channel. On the other hand, if the mode of communication to that device is the same style of XML web services traffic and is subject to this exact same methods of intermediation, then at least in principle, that policy can also govern that channel. And
that's, you know, absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I've been thinking about this for a couple of years. I've yet to see an example of something like that that I could point to. I don't know if you have. I'd be interested to hear about it. But it certainly seems like a good goal.
Yes. You think about that problem. Now I've got this USB thing. And if I can't use the things that I've already invested in,
yep.
and I have to develop something new, number one, it's going to take a long time. Number two, it's going to be expensive. Number three, it's not going to work very well with everything else.
Yep.
And I might have to build a little gateway between it to communicate with other things.
Yep.
Right? And whenever I build a gateway, I've got a versioning problem because the versions change on both sides and I have to continue to maintain that thing to go from version 1 to 2 and 2 to 1 and 3 to 2, et cetera. And I might drop some data if one version evolves faster than the other. Okay, so having everything using a common format and a common way to communicate is very valuable.
Yep.
Okay, it's one language for all devices. A lot of the incentives are really economic. And time-based, right? I can do things a lot faster, and I can do things a lot less expensive if I can use XML.
Yep.
Because I can use that community. Reuse, build on top of the community, stand on top of the shoulders of the giants that built XML.
Yeah.
Right? Why not leverage all that work? It's fantastic. So, yeah, that's really the core philosophy behind efficient XML, is to get it out there and say, there's really no reason not to use XML. It's like I said, we've actually got it plugged into aircraft and vehicles and things like that that used to always use just these proprietary binary formats because
mm-hmm.
that's all they could do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now they can build things so much faster. We've got a couple customers that are working on airborne web services right now where they're sharing a lot of different kinds of data, okay, off of airborne, you know, off of aircraft. And they don't have to build it all themselves. That used to be a huge, expensive process. And now they're using, you know, standard web services engines. Things move a lot faster and they're a lot less expensive when you can leverage that XML community.
Well, I know you've had a fascinating history working with a variety of military applications. It's probably the case that you can say a lot less about those than you would like to. But it would sure be interesting to know as much as can be known about that. And
we're very fortunate to have several military and government customers. This is kind of the quintessential massive enterprise, if you will. They use XML all over the place, and they use it for all the same things everybody else does, SOAP and web services and the like.
Yeah.
But they do have a lot of mobile devices and a lot of wireless devices, and they do have a lot of needs for getting information very quickly and for tracking events very closely. And they also operate a large number of wireless networks, which is very expensive when you think about all the radios you have to put out there to increase bandwidth and all the, you know, frequency management and everything else. So they kind of play the role of a large enterprise. They kind of play the role of a carrier. They kind of play the role of a device manufacturer. They've got kind of the whole ecosystem there. So it's not that surprising that we've had them kind of knocking down our door to get this, if you will. What I can say about the implementations that we've done with them is that if you think about location-based services, okay, you have a map that shows you where a whole bunch of different things are and shows you where you are. Okay, that's an important kind of application to
mm-hmm.
our military customers, real-time situation awareness.
Mm-hmm.
You can get that on an aircraft using XML. You can get that out at a vehicle at the end of a wireless network using XML. You can get it over a very low bandwidth satellite communications link using XML.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put it in the enterprise, in the web servers and in the web services and the pub sub systems and the high speed message routers and the like. And so really this is something that they can plug in all over the place. They have spent enormous amounts of money on proprietary binary formats.
You cooked up a few of them for them at one time yourself, didn't you?
Well, I used to work with this customer quite a bit. Yep. And yes, before XML, I had worked with them to understand what the requirements were for all these different binary formats. So what kind of binary format do you need for a real-time system, for example?
Yep.
What kind of binary format do you need for aircraft? What kind of binary format do you need for vehicles? And at the time, they came up with a whole bunch of different ones. You know, one for vehicles, one for aircraft. And it was the same thing everybody's done, right? I need a binary format that works for my environment. Let's define one that works there.
Yeah.
A couple problems come up. Number one, it's just very, very expensive to build those formats and put them out there and then have to build all your own tools that sit on top of it.
Oh, sure.
I mean, how do you extract data from a binary format? Geez, I'd love to use XQuery or I'd love to use E4X, but I can't.
Yep.
You know, I have to build all that stuff myself. Number one, they're very expensive. And number two, since they're all different, they don't talk to one another without gateways. And
yep.
They have very expensive gateways. Now, as soon as XML came out, I turned around and said, well, I need to educate my customers on this. And I became kind of the XML evangelist. So I went around talking. I probably gave 100 talks in the first year saying, everybody's got to move to XML. You know, the economic benefits are just huge, and it's going to move a lot faster than anything you've ever done before. And that actually worked. A lot of people did move to XML. The people that could did.
Right. And then there were those that couldn't.
And there were those that couldn't. And then there are also some that did that were going, hey, we moved just like you told us to, and now we're 10 times slower than we were before. We don't like you very much anymore. Probably in those 100 talks in the first year, no kidding, in 99% of them, somebody said, hey, what about bandwidth? You know, this stuff looks like it's a lot bigger than what we were doing before.
Yeah.
And the truth is, everybody was doing something before they were doing XML. And the thing that they were doing was generally more efficient than XML. And
yeah.
So the people that have moved have lost some of that efficiency, and that's the price you pay to get the economic benefits of the standard and to get the kind of tempo of evolution that
yep.
we have in the XML community.
And a lot of us can just kind of write that off because a lot
that's
of us
exactly
aren't
right.
in the situation.
Oh.
Maybe the vast majority aren't in the situation where that's going to be an issue. But
that's right. So a lot of people can write it off, and a lot of people can say, we did it, we bit the bullet, and now we're moving on. There's another group of people that said, we did it, we bit the bullet, but we'd really like some way to get back to our old performance. And then there are some that just couldn't move at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And in the commercial market, there's actually more of those than there are people that did make the move. If you look at all the mobile devices, for example, I just saw the recent IDC report that said, let's see, this last quarter, there was 250 million mobile devices sold. So they're on track to be 1 billion mobile devices sold by the end of the year. Okay, this has the potential to expand XML to 5 to 10 times more nodes on the network. And if you think about Metcalfe's law, and how the value of the network increases exponentially with the number of nodes in the network, that applies, right? The more people you get connected on their mobile devices and the more people are able to access the content, the more valuable things get.
This has been really helpful. I think I have a reasonably good grasp of the technical foundations at this point. I will never have much of a grasp of the political nuances. You know, I'm not sure really if I care about that. In broad strokes, this is, to me, obviously a good idea, and I'm glad you're on the case, because I don't know too many people that, like I said, have the kind of combination of skills to sort of pull something like this off. So it sounds like it's going well.
It's going very well. Again, we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish, and I appreciate you spending the time to talk and understand what we're doing. Thanks very much.
Sure.